Recorded live high atop the Mark Blankfield Building in beautiful downtown Chesapeake, it's Phantasmo After Dark with your host, Rob Floyd, and Dr. Tony Mercer, HST.
What's HST?
He sure can't talk.
Oh, look out now.
Oh, lordy. Hey, it's the whatever number episode of the old podcast here.
Well, I think...
7, 8, 12?
I didn't put a number on the intermission episode.
Ah.
Those should be numbered separately. I have decided that's true.
Right on, right on.
So I think this is actually number 9.
All right, number 9. Number 9. Number 9.
That's right.
But hey, here we are, and tonight we're going to talk about the Frederick March, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Probably one of the best versions of Jekyll and Hyde filmed. But before we get into that, a few other things. Don't forget that this podcast sprung from Phantasmo Cult Cinema Explosion, which is a live cult movie night that we put on at the Chesapeake Central Library. Usually the first Friday of every other month, where we show a double feature of some really cool or really bad movies, and it's free admission up, and it's up on the big screen, and there's snacks and door prizes and drinks and all kinds of cool stuff going on all year long.
I believe a Phantasmo just wrapped up last night, did it not?
It did. It was in honor of Black History Month. For February, we did Blaxploitation Night, and we showed Willie Dynamite and Black Dynamite.
And did you have vision?
Dude, that four came in the room. It was a lot of fun. Everybody enjoyed it. And a lot of people had not seen either of the movies, so they had a good time. Coming up in April will be our 10th anniversary of doing Phantasmo. 10 years of putting that on. And we're going to go back and show the first two movies we ever showed, the very first one, Logan's Run and Buckaroo Banzai.
That was the first Phantasmo?
That was the very first one, yeah.
Why? I don't remember that. I remember that night. I don't remember that being the first one.
That was it. And we still.
It's as if it were always there.
And we still have a few people hanging around that were at the first one that still come every time. So that's kind of cool.
And sadly, we have some key personnel no longer around.
Yeah. Oh, here's to you, Blanton, you magnificent bastard, you. But hey, another cool thing coming up. Weekend of March 6th, I think, through the 8th. Anyway, I might have that wrong. First weekend in March, the Williamsburg Classic Film Festival is going to be happening in Williamsburg at the Holiday Inn Patriot. You can look at Williamsburg Classic Film Festival online or on Facebook. And it is a tribute to the golden age of Hollywood. But the most important thing about it this year, I'm always there helping out. And Dick Warlock is going to be one of the guests there this year. Who's Dick Warlock? I'll tell you who Dick Warlock is. He played Michael Myers in Halloween 2. And he's also a stuntman and double for Kurt Russell in, oh God, Big Trouble in Little China, The Thing, Escape from New York. And I'm going to be interviewing him on, I believe it's Friday night there. And we're going to show Halloween 2, and he's going to be running commentary the entire time. So that'll be really cool. Make it out if you can. It's a once-in-a-lifetime thing.
Let's zero in on that for just a moment. You have Dick Warlock, who played Michael Myers in Halloween 2.
Yes.
Not Rob Zombie's Halloween 2.
No, the original Halloween 2 with Pleasance and Jamie Lee Curtis.
And you're going to be screening Halloween 2 with Michael Myers himself giving you a running live commentary.
Yeah.
That is awesome.
You can't get that everywhere.
Now, look, I would not bother to repeat that just for the sake of pimping whatever you happen to be doing this week. That particular thing, not that I won't shill for you, because I'll shill for you.
Because you're a brother. I know that.
That's right. But I'm just saying it wouldn't be necessary, but it's important to emphasize how cool that is. And I know there's a lot of Halloween fans out there.
Yeah.
You need to carry yourself to Williamsburg if you're within a reasonable driving distance.
Because you won't see this at a bigger convention either. No. They won't do stuff like this.
No.
It's impossible. So this is going to be really cool.
But I think a lot of the Phantasmo After Dark audience will be familiar with Phantasmo, Cult Cinema Explosion, familiar with Monster Fest, familiar with the Williamsburg Film Festival, because they're familiar with your Facebook presence. I think, there's very much a sort of Facebook movement that comprises the Phantasmo After Dark audience. But guess what? We've expanded now. Phantasmo After Dark is on iTunes. And what
you don't say.
It is.
That's amazing.
And as much as we appreciate and value all the folks on the Phantasmo After Dark Facebook group, and you know who you are. We'd like to expand and grow and spread like a plague across the nation or across the world.
I was going to say like a cheerleader on prom night.
And you can help us do that, and it's super easy, right? So on iTunes, all you got to do is, you know, search for Phantasmo After Dark, and we'll pop right up. You have the option to give us a star rating or a review. Now, a review sounds like work. I get that. If you're down with doing that work, we'd love to hear from you. Please leave us a review. But hey, if you're like, forget you, man. I don't feel like sitting there typing a damn essay about your stupid podcast.
Just click a star.
Click a star. That's all you got to do. Click if there's five stars available, if you think it's a three-star podcast, you click on the third star, you walk away. And here's what that does. As I understand it, the more star ratings and reviews that you have on your podcast, the more likely it is that folks will find you when they're searching for keywords. So right now, if you search for cult, you'll find this if you search for Phantasm. If you search for cult movies, you're going to have to scroll a lot, okay, before you find us.
Yeah.
But you can fix that, folks. And hey, also, while you're on iTunes, why not hit the subscribe button? Make sure you don't miss an episode.
Don't cost nothing.
Don't cost a thing.
It's free.
Free.
Just like everything we do, just about.
Free and easy.
Yeah.
Like Sunday morning and much like Rob.
That's right. That's right. With that all said and done, hey, if you want to drop us a line another way, how could they do that, Tony?
That was last time. This time.
I believe we have an email, don't we?
Yeah, let me think if I can think of a different way to present
it. Okay, well, while you're thinking of that, you can also drop by the Phantasmo After Dark Facebook page and leave a comment or look at the pictures or do something, good or bad, indifferent. That'd be cool. It'd be great to hear from you.
You're stepping on my gag, man. I'm setting up a gag.
Edit that out then. Go ahead.
No, I can't now.
Start over. Hey, Tony, if they want to get in touch with us, don't we have an email?
Well, you know how many emails we've received at phantasmopod@gmail.com?
Zero.
Two.
Two. Really? Two.
Well, one's from you.
What was it?
Did a test email, right?
A test email. Did I like what we do?
The other one is from iTunes saying, yes, you can be on iTunes. Here's your information. Thank you, iTunes.
We love you, iTunes.
Well,
thanks for listening.
Don't. So clearly, the email address, phantasmopod@gmail.com, we have not managed to make that attractive to the listening audience. How can we make that attractive, sexy for the listening audience?
We don't have anything to give away.
Well, it's on the presentation, baby.
All right.
Hey, babies.
Yeah, there you go.
Why don't you drop us a line, Phantasmo? What's the email address?
I need some Barry White playing in the background.
I'm cutting that shit.
We'll make it sexy next time.
Screw this. This is not going anywhere.
Okay, let's get back to the matter at hand.
Yeah.
Have we shilled or pimped everything that's coming up?
I believe that we have.
Well, then let's get into the topic for tonight.
1932's.
Actually, it was 31.
It was 32.
It was 31. Look it up.
It was 32. It was released on New Year's Eve, 1931.
31. So it was both. If it played overnight.
32, because most of its theatrical run would have been in 32.
Yeah. But technically.
This is not bloody interesting to anyone other than us.
Okay. Well, the point I was going to make is it was the first three of the big horror movies.
Yeah,
the big classic horror monsters or movies that, you know, have stuck around. Frankenstein, well, Dracula in 31, Dracula, and Frankenstein in 31, and then Jekyll and Hyde. Which I don't want to say Jekyll and Hyde gets a bad rap, but it's kind of like the redheaded stepchild of monster movies.
It's pretty well celebrated.
It's pretty well known, but you don't see as much merchandise out for Jekyll and Hyde. You don't hear as many people talk about this movie as you do Dracula, Frankenstein, the Wolfman, the Mummy series, you know, and
in other words, you don't hear as much about it as you do the Universals.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's because it's not a Universal.
No, but and it's bit as good, I think.
Oh, well, it's better than a lot of the Universals. Yeah. I wonder, pure speculation, I really don't know the answer to this, but I wonder if maybe it wasn't included in the syndication packages that were running sort of in the baby boomer era that kind of put
the shock package
that pretty much established the monster fandom as we know it, you know?
Yeah. You know, I don't know. I've got some,
was that primarily Universal product that was in that package?
Primarily it was, at least the first one, I do believe. But I do. I need to go back and look. I do have a couple books that have some good long articles on the shock package, the initial boom of Horror Host and things. I could find out.
So that might be part of it. The other part of it might just be that it was hard to see it complete for a long time.
That's true. I was reading something about that. Yeah.
Well, the DVD release that you can get today is 14 minutes longer than any cut that was in circulation since the 30s.
Like since it first came out. I didn't know that. Man. And, you know, it's a fantastic damn movie.
Yeah.
I was surprised. I went back and watched it again. I had not seen it, I don't know, in a couple of years, I guess. And it's one of those that I forgot how good it was. And I don't know why I forgot, because it's really, really good.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing maybe that's one of the other, maybe everybody else does the same thing. You know, when they see it, and over the years have forgotten about it because the other ones just overshadow as far as hype and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But man, it was a good movie.
Yeah, I mean, I think it probably has, again, to do with the fact that it was cut up, and it there was probably a long stretch of time where it wasn't really revived as far as a lot of theatrical showings. Again, I don't know that that's true,
yeah.
But if it was, it certainly would have been in a very cut form.
Yeah. Which is weird because Freddie March got the Oscar.
Yeah, it was celebrated in his time. I mean, yeah. that's a key point about this movie is that it wasn't a picture.
Yeah,
I mean Paramount was a major studio. The director Ruben Mamoulian was one of their golden boys at that time, and was very well respected and had some serious pull. And he pretty much got to make the movie he wanted to make. You know, mm-hmm. This wasn't. I'm sure they mounted it as a reaction to the success of Universal's Dracula. Earlier in 31, and actually, if I remember correctly, Jekyll and Hyde was in production at the same time as Universal's Frankenstein.
Oh, really?
In fact, yeah.
Wow.
So I'm sure the production was mounted as a response to the success of Dracula, but it wasn't, as some other studios would do, a sort of quick, cheap, tossed off, cashing in on the horror boom.
Yeah.
Yeah, so again, you know, it was a picture. They spent money on it, and March, as you mentioned, the Academy Award for Best Actor. So,
oh yeah,
yeah,
and you know, hell of a job he does with it. And I was reading too that I think he initially wasn't the first choice, or he was the director's first choice, but the studio didn't want him at first because he was known more for romantic comedies and things like that at the time, I think.
Well, from what I know of his work before this, I'm not sure that it's romantic comedy necessarily, but it is...
Or light fare.
Yeah, right. So he was considered a light comedic performer.
Yeah.
He wasn't really looked at as somebody that could pull off heavy drama, and he was fighting against that and sort of jumped at the chance to do Jekyll and Hyde for that reason, but... Mamoulian thought it was very important to have someone who could play the Jekyll part very well. You know,
yeah.
He could be, you know, what he was looking for in that respect. And I think, you know, some of the suggestions, and I can't remember any off the top of my head, but some of the suggestions that the studio made for a lead were rejected by Mamoulian on the basis of, I need someone that can play Jekyll. I can see that guy as Hyde, all right, but it's the, you know, what I've got in mind isn't going to work.
Yeah.
I need someone, you know, young and charming, and he needed Frederick March. Okay,
yeah.
That's what he needed.
But
you know what? The Paramount's first choice to play the part was
Barrymore.
Barrymore, that's right. John Barrymore, the great profile himself, who had played...
who had already done it.
Right, in 1920, I think it was.
Yeah, that's the second silent version.
Actually,
I think.
Well, there's... I don't remember the exact number, but there's some fraction of all the silent movies ever made still exist.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, you know, it's hard to have a complete catalog, but I remember hearing or reading somewhere that there was like three or four.
Oh, really?
Silent.
I knew there were two.
Jekylls before
the
big 1921 that folks know about, you know.
Yeah.
Sort of part of the lost history of the silence or whatever.
Now,
so
here's an important thing to talk about when we're talking about this movie in particular, and the silent Jekyll. When talkies first came in, okay, this was... What year was that roundabout? Do you remember?
29.
Okay, 29. Okay, so this is 31.
Yeah.
This is, I mean, new. Sound films are still just a few years old.
Yeah.
So you're coming off the silent screen acting style and the way they make the movies. So it's a whole new ball game here. And this movie kind of plays like... Like a lot of the movies back then, like a play almost, in the way the actors deliver their lines and the And the dialogue is a little stilted in it. Not natural.
Well,
but it doesn't hurt the picture.
I know what you're getting
at. You
know,
it doesn't hurt the picture.
I personally have a hard time characterizing it that way.
Yeah. You know, well, I'm playing devil's advocate here.
No, I got you. But that's just, you know how I can get. And that's one of that's one of my little peevy things. You know, it's not stilted, damn it. Okay. Just because.
Well, it's different.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's different than what we're used to in later, say 5 years later.
The pretense.
In films.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so yes.
But with that, you know, with that being said, it doesn't hurt this film. I was just trying to set that up insofar as in a roundabout way is that how good if you, that kind of stuff bothers you or you're one of those people that's quaint.
Then switch this off right now.
Yeah.
I don't want to talk
to you. We can't be friends. But this film works on
seriously,
so many...
I'm being a jerk here, but you're right. I mean, it's the early days of sound.
Yeah.
Right? And when the talkies came in, and of course dialogue was key, stage actors were sought after more than they had been prior. I mean, you know, if a stage actor was sought after in the silent era, of course it was because they could act, right? But a lot of times it was just because they had the name value, if they had established themselves on stage. But stage actors became important in the early talkies because it was clear they could talk, right?
Yeah.
They could handle the dialogue. So a lot of times actors in that era were still playing to the last row or playing to the balcony. You know, they were projecting still. It was a very, very large era.
There's not a lot of it in this one, I think, is what's... I mean, there's a little, but not so much. I think that's what sets us apart from a lot of other movies around that time.
Gestures are, you know, broader, and again, you know, we're projecting when we speak. And
but there are a lot of tight close-ups with the camera. Mm-hmm. And even in some of the two shots, it's like they're nose-to-nose, and the camera's tight on them.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a lot of that goes on throughout the film.
Yeah, there's a lot of subjective camera. It begins from a first person subjective, you know, perspective where Mamoulian basically wants us, the audience, to be...
We're seeing through Jekyll's eyes.
I mean, we POV. Are Jekyll, right, his point of view. I mean, it's very unusual. You know, we track around the house and hear him talking to his butler and we're watching the butler, you know, looking right at the camera.
And we don't see Jekyll's face until he looks in the mirror.
Right.
And we're looking in the mirror. Right. And then you go away and you're still... him going through his routine until he gets to the medical college or university or whatever it is where he has to speak in front of the whole, I don't know, student. It's not student body because there's old doctors and young doctors and all this. But this crowd that's come to hear him speak, then the camera turns around and you see him and you see everybody else. It changes. And it goes back to that point of view thing, though, a couple of times, which is odd. But it doesn't take you out of it, you know?
Yeah.
It's not jarring the way it does it.
Yeah.
I think the second time is during the first change, where he's looking in the mirror again and he's going to drink the potion.
There might be... Well, some of those close-ups that you're talking about, some of those, I believe, are meant to be sort of that subjective... POV again.
Yeah.
Certainly, when we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves, but when Miriam Hopkins does her strip for Jekyll.
Oh, yeah. We're going to talk about that.
That's very much from his point of view.
Mm-hmm.
She's looking at the camera. So she's looking at him and thereby us, and we are watching her do what she's doing
and enjoying it.
But yes, when the first change happens, we are watching ourselves change in the mirror. Yeah. And then the first time, Hyde is revealed, I believe, after the change is complete.
He walks up to the mirror, and you see him as he comes, you know, the side of his face, then the full face. It's jarring, but it's not a jump scare.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're waiting. You see it coming because you see yourself getting close to the mirror, and you're waiting. You want to see it, and then it just kind of slowly comes into view, and you're like, whoa. It very effective.
Mm-hmm.
And not quite. You know, it's not like the Phantom reveal in the Chaney Phantom where the mask comes off and you get that jump scare, but it's a different kind of, it's a suspense thing. Mm-hmm. It's building. But back up a little bit, though. A couple things I wanted to get into a little bit is the duality that is portrayed throughout the film. a lot of examples of it throughout the film. I guess you could say the first one is the Jekyll and his butler, the servant. You know, you got the master and the servant, two different classes of people. There's right. a two thing going on throughout the whole movie. And then when he gets to the medical college and he goes to speak, you've got all the old doctors are down low and all the young doctors are up high.
Interesting.
So it's split and the ages are split, you know?
Ah, I had not picked up. Go ahead with your bad self.
I'm going. I took notes, motherfucker. But and it keeps on going throughout the film. The split screen stuff, the De Palma stuff he does.
Yeah, yeah.
The split screen or the fade outs. I think the first one, his fiance, mm-hmm. Muriel, she's trying to get ready for the party, and the screen splits to show the sick old lady that Jekyll's attending yes. to in the free ward. Yep. Mm-hmm. And the contrast in she's just completely yeah, healthy and looking for this, and this woman is sick and almost
dying. It's a wipe. And basically, yeah. the wipe stops yeah. mid-screen, stops. So that it splits where the top is Muriel and the yeah,
mm-hmm. yeah, and then it finishes that wipe, and we go into the other scene with Jekyll to the old lady.
Yeah, and that so I haven't decided if I'm actually going to cut out that part earlier where I was getting grumpy about the whole stilted thing, which wasn't really, you know, that wasn't at you. That's just
I know.
Certain things tend to. Get to me. So I might end up cutting out this part because I'm about to tie these two things together. I get a little annoyed with the, I personally object to the idea that the only good acting is, you know, the more like that guy seems like my neighbor, Fred, you know,
yeah.
the more naturalistic and real it seems to me, then it's good acting. And if it's yeah. in any way, representational, expressionistic,
no,
heightened in any way, then that's not good. Then he's not a good actor. You know, I struggle with that. And what the hell does that have to do with that wife we were talking about? I really wish, you know, that's such a cool thing that they would do, or had the option to do, I should say, uh-huh. in those days, that outside of like a Star Wars movie we don't see much of
yeah.
anymore, that sort of visually interesting scene transition. You know, like a dissolve or a wipe or a split or any of those yeah. cool things that sort of come out of the silence and that hang around for a while yeah. in the talkies and then eventually just kind of go away as everything is driven more and more towards naturalism and not yeah. drawing attention to a cut, you know. I think you're leaving on the table a lot of interesting things that cinema can do that are unique to it
yeah.
if you always insist on not drawing attention to a cut. That's my rant. It's over now. Let's go back okay. to what you were saying.
Well, I need to go back because I missed something. there's two duality things right there together. You've got, before the wipe, you've got the little girl that Jekyll's getting to walk without the crutches.
Yeah.
I forgot about that. He takes the crutches away. She walks, and when she realizes she's walking, she's, you know, overjoyed, and I can walk, and she's real happy. And it fades from her happy face to the old lady in the bed.
Yeah, yeah.
Sick. And it's a long fade. And they yeah. do that a lot, these long overlapping images, and it fades. And then it's you see the old lady, and then we get the wipe to Muriel. I got it backwards.
And as the little girl is walking towards, you might have said this and I missed it, as the little girl is walking towards Frederick March, that's another, you know, POV.
Yeah.
Where she's walking straight and looking right at the camera.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And it's kind of, I mean, and you know, and her exultation, uh-huh. you know, she's full of joy and reverence for the doctor or whatever, and having her do that right at the camera, it's intense.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It is. It's hard to explain sort of the feeling of that, except just to say it's intense, but please go on.
yeah, I mean, you know, we get that, and then the next one, I think, comes up. You get the Jekyll, actually. Mm-hmm. They always call him Jekyll throughout the yeah. movie. Instead of Jekyll.
Which I think is correct, by yeah. the way. I just can't bring myself to
I'm
do
gonna
it.
I'm going to call him Jekyll.
Yeah.
But when after he leaves the ward and he goes to the party and he gets Muriel out in the garden and they've got that tight close up, so it's just the two of them and they're smooching, and the camera tracks away from them, mm-hmm. and I believe down to this statue. Oh no, these two flowers,
yeah.
that are facing each other yeah. in the.
Well, we get another sort of intense close up or two,
yeah.
in there,
and then right on their eyes, yeah, at some
yeah.
point, yeah,
and then like yeah, the two flowers and yeah.
Yeah, and it goes on. I mean, there's a few others. I mean, we'll get to as we go throughout the movie a little bit more. But it was just fascinating that noticing that stuff that I didn't remember at all watching the movie. And I want to watch it again now because I enjoyed it so much. Mm-hmm. And I'm surprised that over the years I haven't watched it more. Like, I've watched Frankenstein. I watched The Wolfman. And I think it's going to be one of my, I don't know, top 10, mm-hmm. top 5. After having really watched it and looked at it again, I can't say enough good things about it. I'm going to keep gushing over it throughout the podcast here. But a couple other things I do want to point out is because we're coming out of the silent era, there's no incidental music in the movie whatsoever, and that I noticed. Except you hear when they're at the party, you mm-hmm. hear the music in the background from them dancing. But throughout it, there's none. And unlike Dracula, which that one. We've said it before. You got to be wide awake to watch Dracula. Barring Lugosi's performance,
yeah.
the movie itself is slow. And this doesn't hurt it a bit. You don't no. really notice it at all. This moves at a pretty good clip throughout the whole thing.
Yeah, you don't really notice the lack of incidental music because note my reaction. And I've seen this movie many times.
Yeah.
But note my reaction when you said that. I went, huh.
Yeah, I know. I caught that. I was like, no, really? There was no music.
I'd never even thought about it.
And yeah. I tell you, another thing that's amazing is with all the camera, the tracking, the camera movement around the sets
yeah.
and throughout the street and the dollying and everything. They didn't have Steadicam stuff back then.
Yeah, that was really hard to do, especially in the early days of sound.
Yeah, and it is smooth.
Yeah.
The camera moves like it's gliding around. Mm-hmm. It's amazing, the camera work in this film. And we'll get to we talk about the changes, the makeup changes here in a minute, too. There's a couple things I noticed that I'd never noticed before, because mm-hmm. I guess I never pay attention to it. But let's talk about Miriam Hopkins. Because right. We're at that point in the film.
Well, so here's another set of two, right?
Oh, did she ever? <That's>,
okay, yes, that too. But what I meant was the two women in, the woman in Jekyll's life and the woman in Hyde's life, basically,
yeah.
right? We have the two women,
yeah.
Muriel and Ivy,
yeah.
played by Miriam Hopkins,
uh-huh.
The good girl and the bad girl, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, but wait, before we get into Ivy, though, Muriel doesn't have a whole lot to do in the film.
Just be the good girl. Yeah, that's it.
But she does it well. I mean, if you go back and watch it, what she does and little subtle things she does with her reactions and the way she delivers the lines,
yeah.
she sells her part without overdoing it.
Yeah.
And her deep love for Jekyll and supporting her man regardless, against her father's wishes,
right,
and everything, and you believe her character,
right,
is what I'm getting at. She does a lot with a little bit to work with.
It's true. Well, her primary function is to sort of personify and draw out Jekyll's sexual frustration. I mean, that's kind of what she's there
well,
for,
yeah.
for the most
oh,
part.
Oh, he wants to get married, something fierce.
And it's something you see a lot in, the films of golden age Hollywood, how, you know, we want to hurry up and get married, and why can't we hurry up and get married is a stand-in for we haven't got it on yet, and we're really horny and want to get it on.
We want to do it.
Yeah, but whatever's going on in the movie prevents us from. And that's very much what's at play here, you know,
yeah.
because in that the profession of love scene that you mentioned earlier with the intense close-ups and the kissing and the flowers and all that business.
Yeah,
that they are. Speaking of how they just desperately want to get married, but her father wants them to wait. And, you know, Jekyll leaves that scene frustrated. Wait, wait, wait. Why is it always wait?
Yeah.
And, of course, this is when he meets sexy Ivy, the prostitute.
And he saves her from a customer. Because they never come out and call her a prostitute in the film. They never say that. Now, one of her gentleman callers is trying to beat her up or argue with her about something and hits her. And Jekyll runs over there and punches the guy and shoos him away and then carries Ivy up the stairs to her apartment. And at this point, she doesn't really realize what's going on.
Now, according to Greg Mank's commentary, when Jekyll carries Ivy up the stairs and you hear someone say, "One of Ivy's," the line was "one of Ivy's customers."
Yeah.
And customers got cut. And when you listen, you can hear the cut. You know, one of Ivy's, like that. You know?
Yeah.
So.
But, yeah, he brings her up there and sets her on the bed. And she's still bitching about the guy hitting her in until he, like, sets her down. And then she realizes where she is. And she looks up and sees that he's a well-dressed gentleman. And her tone changes like that. And she becomes infatuated, for lack of a better word, with Jekyll. And so begins one of the steamiest scenes in the film, or in film of that time. Where she tries to start to seduce the doctor.
Yeah.
And does a damn fine job of it.
She does.
Now, we've talked about this in many times before. This is a pre-code film, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, in this era, it was pretty much anything goes. But a lot of films didn't take advantage of that. So, this is pretty damn risque for the time in film.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't so much that it was anything goes. It was just a lot more went
well, yeah,
than would go between 34 in the 60s.
Okay. Yeah. But this scene is...
Because, you know, even though the production code at this point wasn't enforced, you still had to be concerned with what the, you know, local exhibitors would think. You know?
Yeah, which is why it got cut.
You wanted it to play in the Catholic markets and whatnot, which was a, you know, that's not just, I didn't grab Catholic out of the air. That was a very real thing in the time.
Yeah.
You know, the Catholic League of Decency were big movers and shakers in the film censorship world. But anyhow,
but compared to the horror films that we're used to seeing, i.e. Universal.
Yeah.
None of them had anything as steamy or as sexy as the scene where he's putting her to bed.
No,
she's trying to.
No, for sure. Compared to those. No, you're no, absolutely.
Yeah. So. And it works even today.
Yeah.
I mean, watching it the other night, I was like, damn, Miriam Hopkins is a very sexy and attractive lady.
Yeah.
In the scene, if you haven't seen it, go see the movie. We say this about pretty much just anything we talk about. If you haven't seen it, go see the damn movie. Rent it, buy it, borrow it.
Yeah.
This is a good film. But this particular scene where Jekyll is in his full evening attire, top hat, cape, tails, cane, and when she sees who he is, she then complains about, my ribs hurt, or he hurt. Oh, no, the first thing. She says her leg's bruised, and he looks and he says, "Well, you don't need to wear your garter so tight." And she grabs his hand and puts it on her thigh,
right?
And looks up at him, and it's like, "Whoa, where'd she put his hand?" I mean, you know, it took me by surprise. I wasn't expecting that in an old film like this. And he's just kind of like playfully, like, "Oh yeah, whatever," you know, ha ha ha, the whole time.
Yeah,
like he's just enjoying the flirtation, but not taking it seriously. And she's really trying to seduce him. She was seducing me.
Well, you know, she gets dressed. She gets undressed so that she can get in bed and rest, because that's doctor's orders.
Yeah, the best medicine rest.
But in order for her to rest in her bed, of course, she has to take off her clothes, which she does in a very seductive way. And of course, there's that, and she does, and we get that first person again perspective where she's doing it. She's stripping for the camera. We are watching her.
Now, all we see, really, is she hikes her skirt up above her knees and rolls her stockings down. But it's extremely sexy the way
she
does it.
Takes off her garters and throws them at Jekyll.
Yeah.
And then you get that great moment where she throws her garter at Jekyll, and then it cuts to the garter landing at his feet. And what we see is his feet and legs and his cane.
Yeah.
So he takes his cane and puts it inside the garter.
What's he trying to say there?
Yeah.
But the whole time she's doing this, like you said before, she's looking right at the camera, which is us. She's looking right at us and smiling or grinning while she's doing this. And it's very effective.
Yeah.
And then the next thing, you know, it goes to Jekyll and it cuts back to her getting under the covers or already under the covers.
Side boob.
Yeah. Well, you don't see that right away. But she gets under the covers.
That's where my mind went right away.
Well, mine too, but I was savoring the moment here.
Nah.
But she says, I forget what she says, but she calls him over and then she pulls him down and starts to kiss him. He lets her kiss him. He goes, you know, there, and then the other doctor comes in, all stuffy, and that's when we see the side boob. Jekyll sits down on the bed and she sits up and they break from the embrace. And I was like, side boob.
Yeah.
I was not expecting that in this old film either. Yeah. And Marion Hopkins didn't give a damn. Yeah.
And then you, and remember, I mean, he's letting her kiss him. But this scene follows directly from the scene where he's chased off from his girlfriend and feeling very, very frustrated because they can't get married.
Yes.
Air
quotes, get married.
So she kisses him and, you know, he says, let that kiss be my fee. And as he's leaving, we have that great moment where, she sticks her leg out off the side of the bed from under the covers and leans forward with her eyes glinting and she's swinging
right
her leg back and forth and she's whispering, come back soon.
And the leg is swinging like a clock pendulum.
And then we continue to see the swinging leg superimposed over Jekyll as he leaves.
With the other guy, yeah. They're walking and talking and that superimposed shot of the leg swinging. And
like
it stays here for a while, I was saying earlier.
So cool.
Yeah.
Making it very clear what's on his mind as he's leaving that establishment. And you can still hear her whispering on the soundtrack too. So cool. And I feel like, because we talked about that scene and you've said it a couple times, that it's more than you expected to see in an old movie like this. And I feel like, and we already mentioned how, the movie was cut over the years and how the DVD represents a 14 minutes longer cut than had been seen in a long, long time. And I feel like you can't really talk about this movie without talking about the code. At least I can't,
No.
So I don't necessarily want to derail your train of thought, but I would definitely like to go.
Yeah. Go, son, go.
So, I mean, and you'll hear that. I mean, folks who are really, really familiar with, the silent era and the early talkie era will know this more or less. But you do hear that a lot. I mean, the thought is that films over time have gotten progressively more permissive. That in the very early days, everything was very buttoned down and chased.
Yeah.
And then, more and more over time, the content, shall we say, matured. Right?
Yeah.
But that's not actually true. What happened is that there was a drive toward Puritanism in the mid-30s when self-imposed censorship entered the industry that caused everything to be cleaned up and buttoned down and very chaste to in some circumstances, ridiculous degree for a long time. But that happened after things were already in full swing. In the silent era and in the early days of the talkies, what is now referred to as the pre-code era, you had, mature, not only sort of lascivious content, nudity and more than side boob, full on nudity, depending on where you're looking.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't a big deal for actresses to do nudity
and
back
sex
then.
And drug use and alcohol use and
Satanism
and graphic violence and things that you don't really associate with movies of the 30s necessarily. But not only mature themes in that sense, but mature themes in a true sense, in a truly mature sense. Movies about divorce, which don't make a woman look like some kind of damn criminal because she's divorced her husband. Real mature adult, themes around sexuality that's not dressed up to some extent as we just really want to get married and have a family, The movies were, by this point, pretty grown up, but what happened was...
Do tell.
So, again, there were complaints, right,
yeah.
As you would expect. There were, religious groups and other, sort of special interests, which at that time had a lot of sway, a lot of political sway, a lot of business stake. That would cause trouble for movies as they were being distributed around the country, and that would complain. And the industry began to fear that the government would step in and impose censorship. So, right. So in order to prevent that, the industry decided to police itself.
Yeah.
So they came up with a production code, which is referred to as the Hays Code a lot of time.
Oh, yeah. Right? Yeah.
So uh-huh. Will Hays was in charge, was the guy in charge of the body that was meant to oversee all of this self-regulation in the film industry. And that code was written under his watch and is referred to as the Hays Code. Now, the Hays Code comes in, I don't remember exactly the year, but it's sometime in the late 20s.
Yeah.
Right?
Uh-huh.
It's when the Hays Code is established. But it isn't really enforced.
That
doesn't,
yeah.
That's the thing. It doesn't really happen that way. Like, Hays was pretty, shall we say, amenable. You know,
it's there. Let's everybody agree to it and police ourselves, sort of.
Hays was in the pocket. So what would happen was that Hays' office would make a lot of suggestions. I mean, they would look at the scripts and they would screen things. And they would have things cut here and there. But they would basically make a lot of suggestions that the producers may or may not choose to follow.
Yeah.
It wasn't really until this cat, Joseph Breen, took over that office in, I don't remember exactly what year that was, but the year where the production code really begins to be enforced is 34.
Oh, okay.
And that, uh-huh. And that's under Breen's watch, and that's when things get super puritanical. And you know, the horror boom of the early 30s is one big reason why that happened. It wasn't even so much the sex, but it was the sadism and the, you know, sexual violence is a very prominent theme in the early talkie horrors.
If
you look at that, if you look at something like, and I don't mean sexual violence like, on-screen rape or anything, but sadism associated with sex. I did a panel on this one year at Monster Fest.
Oh, yeah,
where I showed all these great clips, including some clips from Jekyll and Hyde.
Yeah. Well, maybe we'll do a podcast. We'll revisit that in a podcast.
Yeah.
That'd be interesting, because I missed the panel.
It was my favorite. It was my, of the panels that I'd done, it was my personal favorite.
Yeah.
And I actually did a lot of research on it instead of, you know, just running my mouth for an hour like I sometimes do. But
like we do here.
Like we do right here on Phantasmal After Dark.
But, you know, like you're saying, though, that's sexual violence, more or less. There's a bit of that in this.
Right. Violence associated with sex and sexuality versus sexual violence, like I said, in a on-screen rape kind of way or whatever. Like if you're looking at, I showed this clip in the panel from The Mask of Fu Manchu, where Myrna Loy, as Fu's daughter, is having a man whipped and appears to be having some sort of orgasm while she's enjoying it to such a degree that she's ecstatic. She's, you know, her hands are shaking and her whole body's vibrating and she's sort of moaning, and it's really crazy. And then there's the torture scene in, you know, Murders in the Rue Morgue, where Bela has that one young woman crucified on a X, right? And it's making I'm probably going to just need to wrap this up right now, because I could go on and on and on.
Save it for the other
podcast.
We'll
save it for another podcast where we'll talk just about this. But the point of all this rant is that there was a time, as a matter of fact, Friedrich March was in DeMille's Sign of the Cross.
I was going to bring that up earlier, Sign of the Cross.
In which you get some nudity.
Claudette Colbert.
Yes, sir. And some pretty graphic violence and a lot of sensationalist content.
I've been wanting to see that for a long time.
Well, that's a funny thing about DeMille, though, is, you know, he's associated with these Bible movies. But if you go back and watch his early stuff.
A lot of violence
stuff,
in the Bible.
true. But if you go back and watch his early stuff, it's not just that he has the nudity and the sex and the violence in these pictures, is that he presents it in a way, it's a very sort of leering, sensationalist kind of approach that he takes to this stuff. So, wow, tangent. Anyway, back to you, Rob.
Hey, all right. Here we are at Phantasmo After Dark. No, that's good stuff. That's exactly what we're talking about, though. I mean, it's important to really get into that, to understand this film,
right,
and why it's important, and what's going on within the film. Before we get to that, though, that part where the violence and all is pretty intense. Right after Jekyll, see, I did it. Jekyll,
you did.
Right after he leaves Ivy this first time, he's immediately in his lab. Now, is this, he's frustrating and he wants to, you know, there's no internet, so what's he going to do? He's got to get this frustration out. So he immediately goes to his lab and starts working on this potion. He's still in his tux in the lab. He's taken off the jacket and the vest, but he's still got the tux pants and the tux shirt on. He hasn't even bothered to change or put on a lab coat.
He's a man on a mission, baby.
Yeah, and he whips his potion up, and then, like we said, you know, it goes from point of view. He drinks it in the mirror. And now, for the longest time, the way this change was done wasn't known. We know now, and we've been known for years, but it happens right in front of your eyes on camera, and there's no dissolves, there's no cutaways, but you see Jekyll drink the potion, drop the glass, there are no cuts, he's looking in the mirror, and he's grabbing his throat and making these grimaces, and all of a sudden he starts getting these dark circles under his eyes, and his lips start to kind of change, get darker and change shape, and there's lines appearing on his face, and, you know, how did they do that? It's very simple. It's black and white. They did the makeup in red on his face and put a red filter over it so you wouldn't see it. And as they slowly pull that filter away, you see the red that you wouldn't have seen with the filter. It's amazing. Simple, but effective as hell. And it looks beautiful on camera.
Yeah. It just magic, you know, his face just magically changes.
Yeah. Right. Whereas in like the Wolfman, you see the dissolves and how he's moved position slightly.
No cut, no transition.
Yeah.
No visible movie magic of any kind. You're watching him dead on and you see his face change.
And then he kind of faints, falls down the room, spins, and when he comes back up, he's got the full makeup on with the teeth and a little bit of brow and the spiky hair. And you know, and his eyes are a little bigger and he's and then he acts more animalistic or almost simian.
Right. Yep, very much so, because in the book, the split between Jekyll and Hyde is supposed to be, you know, separating the good in a man from the evil in a man, whereas Mamoulian's approach was to separate the spiritual from the low animal self. That was sort of the difference of his approach, and so he wanted that low animal self to basically be like a Cro-Magnon, man,
which to be
very literally realized as the low animal version of a human.
And I love the way he plays Hyde because it's different than other versions I've seen.
Yeah, it's almost comical at
first. It's almost comical, and he's almost like a monkey.
And yeah, he really is. It's almost he's comical.
He's a dick.
And it isn't, you don't really, once we begin to realize how cruel and awful Hyde is and how dangerous he is, it changes your sort of perspective on him. But at first, he's just kind of funny and almost.
He's kind of funny, but like an asshole.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, he bumps into somebody and he like pushes them and gives them that look, or he trips the waiter who, why he got pissed off at the waiter. But the coolest thing about this makeup, I'm going to go ahead and get into this now since, you know, we talked about the first change, is that I didn't really notice all these years of seeing pictures from the film didn't register with me until watching it the other night, that the change gets, each time he changes into Hyde, the makeup is progressively more animalistic, more caveman-like with each change. And I didn't really notice it until the second change. I'm watching the scene where he's already changed, and I was like, wait a minute, his hair's different. Okay, maybe it's time, it's gotten longer, you know? But then I thought, well, no, his face is different a little bit, and it's drastically different at the end, the last change, drastically different from the first time he changes. He's got a more pronounced brow, deeper sunken eye sockets, a little more hair on the face. The teeth are a little more gnarly, and the hair is more manic and you know, wild and bedhead looking. Where at first he's got short spiky hair, and then the next time you see him, it's long, a little longer and slicked back. And he's trying to be a gentleman at first, you know, but he looks a little caveman, like a little odd at first. Well, he looks really odd, but everybody around him just, they see him and like, but it doesn't look out of place.
Yeah, but there's a, but you know, for me as a viewer, there's a sort of a, again, before we understand the depths of his cruelty, there's a pathetic quality to him.
Like he's deformed is what people kind of get the look. They're like, oh, that poor man, that kind of look.
Yeah.
And he starts acting like an asshole. But it fascinated me, the makeup in this, how it does that, how it progressively, it's subtle at first, you know, and it's beautiful. It's a beautiful makeup job. I can't remember the guy that did it off the top of my head now.
Well, yeah, this is just one of these great expressionist pictures where, you know, everything that you see, everything visual has been thought through and considered, and it's all meant to communicate something directly to the to the viewer. You know, nothing is just there to be there, you know. So
now, one of the other changes, I had to rewind and watch two or three times in a row, four or five times in a row. I even called Phyllis over. I said, come here and look at this. Because it's amazing. There was a cut, but it took me a couple times to catch it. He's sitting in a chair, and he starts doing the same thing. I think we see the lines start to form, and then the camera tracks down to his right hand. I think it's his right hand. And, of course, they do the same thing with the filter light, where it gets a little darker, his hand gets a little darker, and then it's lighter, then it's darker. And then the camera tracks back up to his face, and he's got the teeth in, and a little bit of the makeup, a little bit more of the pronounced makeup than he had with the lines. And it looked like the camera just went down to his hand for a second and went back up. Okay, I'll buy that. They stuck something on him real quick while the camera was on his hands. Okay. And then it goes down to the other hand that has hair on it, and it looks a little more gnarly than the previous hand. Okay, they made up one hand and more than they made up the other. And then the camera comes back up, and he's in full face makeup. Now, I think there's a cut that second time, but it's not like a cut like you see, because it looks like the camera tracks from his face down to his right arm, smooth, back up to his face, down to his left arm, and then back up to his face. Mm-hmm. Incredible camera work from back then. It's not a lot of, even in some of the Universal stuff, I mean, and we'll take the Wolfman because that's where you get the changes, the dissolves, and where the head or whatever is changing, the hands or the feet, they move a little bit. Either the camera moved a little bit, position, or Chaney moved a little bit. You know, this, even if there's a cut, he did not move, the camera did not move. It's a smooth gliding motion up his arm and back to the face. It's incredible. Incredible work. I was really blown away each time he changes the way they do it and the way the camera moves. You got to see it. I can't describe it as well as watching it. I mean, it's just, it, especially for the time, 31, come on.
Yeah. There's a lot of, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just, that's where I was. They do use, I think, the change back at the very end, or maybe there's one a little earlier, where you do get a dissolve, a Wolfman dissolve change, where he changes back to Jekyll.
Right.
And that's the only time, and that's really quick, though. Yeah. It's a quick dissolve, so whereas the Wolfman kind of goes kind of slow. This was a very fast, so if there was any changes in camera or movement, it wasn't as noticeable because it's done really quickly.
See, I stopped myself from going on a tangent there a second ago, but hell with it, I'll go ahead and go on it.
Just go
real quick. You say, and you're right, that it's especially good for 31, but see, again, that's one of those things, just like the whole, you know, films got progressively more permissive thing over time isn't necessarily true.
Yeah.
It was more and then less and then more again, right? It's good for 31 because we're still in the early days of sound, and it was the sound equipment that made everything so cumbersome and that made so many movies of the very early 30s, static, like film stage plays or whatever, and really only, you know, inventive and ingenious directors managed to work their way around that. Because in the silent era, you had a lot of great work. Like, as a matter of fact, the moving camera in this movie, what it puts me in mind of is Murnau.
Okay.
Like, if you watch, like, Sunrise or something like that, you'll see a lot of just incredible, you know, Murnau is like a you know, top of the mountain example, but you'll see a lot of really great moving camera work in the latter years of The Silence in 27, 28, 29. You know, Sternberg is another one that I can think of off the top of my head where you'll see a lot of great motion like that. So when sound comes in to a large degree, that stuff goes out.
Yeah.
And you certainly don't see Universal doing that kind of thing, you know. And some of that might be, you know, Paramount major studio making an A picture versus, you know, Universal's doing Dracula and Frankenstein at that time. And some of it is just what Mamoulian was driving to. You know, here's a guy with a vision and talent and will and more or less carte blanche at the studio because he was, you know, revered in that moment at least, you know, pushing towards greatness.
Yeah.
But please continue.
Well, I think what I was getting at when I said good for the time is compared to stuff today. I think because the technology today that they use for, you know, and CGI aside, which I don't even get on that tangent, this to me, this is in Jekyll here, the change is, it's just incredibly done. It's smooth. All the changes are very smooth and don't look cheap or cheesy.
Yeah.
And holds up to any transformation scenes I've seen today.
Yeah.
Like I said, barring cartoon CGI stuff. I urge you watch this movie. Go ahead and watch it. It just took me aback. Like I said, I had that one scene I had to watch three or four, five or six times in a row, just to kind of take it all in at how good it was.
Yeah, you weren't in any way wrong when you said it was good for the time. I just wanted to sort of clarify that we're talking about sort of a we're not talking about a situation where it's just, you know, technology progressing forward from zero to wherever we are today. We're just talking about a time where we're coming out of a very static period in movies and trying to sort of reach back to a more you know, visually interesting cinematic approach.
Yeah. Now, getting away from the changes, which is, you know, as a kid watching monster movies, that's your big scenes. So we could talk about that a little while longer, but getting away from the changes and getting back to the relationships.
Oh,
what you got?
Ha! You know what I am?
A light bulb just went off in your head.
Yes,
you weren't looking at notes. That just popped in your head. What?
What popped into my head was, I wasn't looking at notes either. I was looking at IMDb because we were talking about all this great camera work, and it occurred to me we should name check the cinematographer, Carl Struss.
Oh, duh.
And I thought to myself, does Struss ever work with Murnau? Sunrise.
Oh, well, there you go.
He shot Sunrise. What did I say? Hey, that reminds me of Sunrise.
Well,
good for Carl Struss and good for me.
Yay, Tony.
Yay. Please continue.
As Brother Eckridge said, we are simple creatures. It don't take much. But getting back to the film, as we see where Hyde develops his relationship with Ivy, where he pretty much kidnaps her, sets her up in an apartment, and keeps her for his pleasure, and she really wants no part of it, but is kind of stuck. And it's kind of, it's put in your face, but it's also suggested the violence towards her. You don't really see anything except him not letting her go and chasing her around the room. Then I guess he throws her down the bed once. I don't know if he hits her. I can't remember. But, and then of course the scene goes away, but there's this one great,
if he doesn't need to.
No.
Yeah. Because that's, and again, sorry to interrupt, but you'll often hear that you know, the horror movies of this era, they just aren't scary, you know. And okay, sure they're not. I mean, of course they're not. You know,
no, it's not somebody jumping up yelling in your face.
Not anymore. But I will say, the scenes of Hyde's cruelty to Ivy, still very emotionally affecting.
Oh, it makes you a little uncomfortable.
Oh, it makes me very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very intense.
But the last scene that he has with Ivy, well, I don't know. Do you want to talk about the scene where she meets Jekyll?
It's a good scene.
Yeah, where
makes you hate him. I mean,
yeah. Well, Jekyll decides that he's done with Hyde. Mm-hmm. He's not going to be Hyde anymore. By this point, he's the reason he's taken up with Ivy is because Muriel, her father, has taken her, and they've been gone away a month on holiday. So he has no. He's really frustrated because he can't even kiss her.
Yep. God, I just need to get married.
So he spends more time as Hyde so he can shtup Ivy to his heart's content.
He needs to just marry himself is what he needs to do.
But so this whole time, so she's back in town. His doctor friend, he goes and asks for his help because he's, you know, in trouble. And he changes from Hyde to Jekyll right in front of him. And that's a great shot of, you've seen this still a lot of times where Hyde is holding the potion up, getting ready to drink it, and it's, oh man, it's a beautiful, the makeup is beautiful, it's a great, nicely composed shot, you know? And then he changes and tells him that he's killed somebody or something, I think, is he at that point? No. Anyway, I gotta go back and watch it now for that. But, so, yada 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 happens, and he goes back home, and he's decided he's not gonna be Hyde anymore. And he sends his butler to give Ivy like $50 or £50 or whatever it is to take care of herself so she can just go away and live her life. But the butler, she says, who's this from? Oh, it's from Dr. Jekyll. He wants you to have this. So she wants to go thank him. And then she sees, oh, you're the guy that saved me that day. And then she cries up a storm and says she'll do anything, you know, I'll be your slave, I'll love you, I'll do anything, you just keep him away from me. And Jekyll's, no, you don't need to do that. I assure you Hyde will never bother you again.
Yeah.
Famous last words. Anyway, she ends up going away. And Jekyll is going over to see Muriel. They've decided they're going to get married, right? And they're going to announce it at this dinner.
He's tired of marrying himself.
Yeah. So they've convinced the father to let him get married, and Jekyll is, you know, walking through the park one day, and he stops sitting on a bench to look at this bird in the tree. And a cat goes up in the tree and kills the bird, and then that just sets Jekyll off, and he changes to Hyde without the serum.
Yeah.
At this point. And then he goes back to Ivy, this is a great scene. She's looking in the mirror, beautifully shot. She's happy. Isn't she like singing a little song or something?
Yeah, I think so.
And like Hyde, you know, and saying something out loud about Hyde being gone and never bothering again. And you see in the mirror what's happening behind her. You see the door open and Hyde come into view in the mirror, and the look of terror on her face.
As many times
amazing.
As I've seen it, every time I think, oh no.
Yeah.
You know, emotionally it works. I'm not sure that I made that point very well when I first brought it up, but you know, when I watch Frankenstein, I don't watch it to be scared. You know, when I watch Dracula, I don't watch it to be scared. I watch it for the atmosphere and the artistry that goes into
the beautiful films
to creating that. But I still have it's not fear necessarily, but I still have a strong emotional reaction to this picture when I watch it.
It makes you a little anxious. Yeah. It makes you uncomfortable because you know nothing good is getting ready to happen.
Yeah.
And Hyde, we've already seen that he's gone from being beyond asshole to being brutal, and now you know he's going to kill her.
Yeah.
You know he has nothing in mind except to end her at this point because he's pissed because he remembers everything that happens that Jekyll does.
Right.
And this scene where he just, you know, he chokes the life out of her. You see him start to choke her, but then she goes out of view. But you still feel the brutality of it.
Yeah.
And here, this is another one. There's those the duality contrast going on, where the camera, I think it tracks away from him choking her to this statue of this angel holding someone that's fallen or is dying or something. This porcelain statue, and it's just total contrast, but very, very effective.
Yeah.
Another scene where I don't know if I did go back and watch it twice just because of that, but it really stood out, you know, and because like you said, it's uncomfortable because the anticipation of her looking in the mirror and being happy, and you know he's coming in, and then when you see the door open to him walk in, it's like,
Yeah. I really
so effective.
I really dig that whole, panning to a piece of art that sort of represents the moment or the scene that we just saw. That's actually something I associate with Mario Bava because that's something he likes to do. But it's very much, it's very much that expressionist thing again.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and the whole film is, and I'm sure there's some things that I missed where there's that duality stuff going on, but I did hit on the lecture hall.
Yeah, you got me there, I have to say. That's good stuff.
But there's a few other things in there. I'm sure the characters, their interplay and stuff like that has a lot of that going on. But yeah, it's an underrated film, an unsung film. It gets lost in the bigger names, the more popular names of the monsters, but it's moved up a few notches.
Well, I think it's probably unsung to some extent in the monster movie fandom.
Yeah,
I could be wrong, but I think it's pretty much considered to be, generally speaking, the best Jekyll and Hyde adaptation.
Oh, hands down, I would say.
But when you're, talking to other monster fans, it's not necessarily the first thing that comes up.
But when you say Jekyll and Hyde, that's the Hyde that you picture.
Oh, yeah.
That's what everybody thinks Hyde looks like. It doesn't look like Spencer Tracy. Doesn't look like Karloff and the stunt Eddie Parker the from Abbott Costello.
But the Hyde in that Bugs Bunny cartoon, that looks like Spencer Tracy. And I do think of that when I think of Hyde sometimes, so...
It don't look like Jack Palance. It don't look like... I'm trying to think whoever else played Hyde.
Tony Perkins?
Damn sure don't look like Tony Perkins.
Right.
Look like John Malkovich. Oh, ooh. How about that? That was an awful goddamn film, too. Mary Riley.
Yeah.
I got to see it for free, and I wanted to ask for my money back when it was over. boring.
I just remember the trailer. The trailer?
Right on.
The trailer. Mary Riley. Please continue.
That's no comeback. It's not by a damn sight.
No, it really isn't.
I don't know. I mean, I'm starting to repeat myself just saying how good the movie is because I can't say it enough times. I was really taken aback at how much... I kept asking myself, why did I not remember that this film was this good? And I'm really kind of glad because it's almost like I've discovered a new film, a new old classic monster movie. And it makes me want to seek out other stuff on it.
Right.
About it. And even, I want to find some merchandise. I want to find some, some Frederick March Jekyll and Hyde merchandise that... Because I don't think I have any stuff in my collection of Hyde, really.
Well, the Basil Gauges Hyde.
Oh, well, yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Just
beautiful.
Saying.
And the Bama. Mm-hmm. There's a cover to one of the monster books, I think, that is Hyde. And it's a Bama... painting. It's beautiful.
So on the censorship angle,
yes,
again, we talked about how much got cut out of this thing.
Yeah.
And much of the interesting things we've described, as a matter of fact, got cut in part or wholly over the years.
Oh, I'll bet that most of all the scenes with Ivy, probably.
So even in the pre-code era, you still had censorship to contend with, and it would work kind of like this. We said that at this point there was no, federal regulation over the movie business that handled, censoring objectionable content, right? Uh-huh. But you did have state censor boards all over the country, and it was these state censor boards that the religious special interests and various other folks that I mentioned earlier had the ear of. And it was also, to some extent, just the exhibitors, like I said. Now, this is also an era where the studios owned a lot of the theaters, too. So this was maybe minor problem.
Yeah.
But you still had issues with the exhibitors just kind of knew their market. And they're like, okay, I'm not showing that if you don't, cut this or cut that. So... Hollywood would produce a film, and in the Los Angeles premiere, it would be uncut, more or less.
Yeah.
But as it was distributed around the country, you know, this area of the country would see one cut and that area of the country would see another. It was just whatever was considered objectionable to that particular region was cut. So you'd have prints flying, you'd have different cuts and various prints flying around all over the place.
Well, you know, that permeated all through the 70s and up to the early 80s at least. Especially, you know, the drive-in circuit, the grindhouse circuit. And, I mean, you know just as well as I do, as many different prints there are of a lot of films that we like. A lot of the Nashi films, Nashi films, Paul Nashi, there's a lot of different cuts, prints going around of those films. A lot of others, which I'm drawing a blank right now, of those drive-in films that would play regionally, and different regions would get different cuts. But it's amazing that it went from the 30s up through, I want to say at least the early 80s, until, you know, the drive-ins faded out and the grindhouse theaters all got cleaned up. I don't know.
Yeah, true. And then when the code begins to be enforced in the 30s, now you've got, you know, censorship happening right at the studio right out of the gate, where things just not getting made. But, you know, you have this whole catalog of pre-code films. And then when the code is enforced, it's not like those things are just allowed to skate, right? So you had movies where the negatives were actually edited for content years later. And you had many films that were just tossed in a vault and, you know, never played the revival houses and just weren't shown, you know. And some that were, but only in you know, chopped down form.
Yeah.
So for a long time, the only version or versions of this film you could see were ones that were highly edited for content. And it wasn't really until, again, the DVD era that you saw sort of the fully formed thing. And I think that probably does have a lot to do with why its reputation isn't quite as strong as its quality suggests it should be, as a matter of fact. Because
I get that totally.
I mean, there's a lot of films, you could take the sexuality out of them or you could take the violence out of them and they still work. But, I mean, all that stuff is so intricately intertwined in this picture. It's all important and it all needs to be there to have its full impact.
Yeah, well, I mean, you think about it. If you take, you know, 2/3 of the scene where we first meet Ivy away, then there's nothing. I mean, there's no characterization there. There's no motivation for him to do anything. It loses everything. And then if you take at the end, or the couple times we see Hyde being violent towards her, then there's no reason to dislike him as much as you're supposed to.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, you're totally right on the nose on that there.
Yeah.
The film delivers. I mean, it pulls you in different directions and makes you like this character and not like that character and feel sorry for this character and like you're supposed to.
Yeah.
There's none of that ambiguous, about the characters. It's extremely well done.
The problem that I always have, and I'm not sure, this might just be me, is that I always find it difficult to really completely separate Jekyll and Hyde, you know, and sort of absolve Jekyll for the things that Hyde does.
Okay.
You know, and I think the film definitely wants you to do that.
Yeah, well, you know, that's different from what I read. I've never read the book.
Yeah.
Okay, the original story. But I was reading a little something the other night about it, where the Jekyll in the movie is a completely different person than he is in the book.
Yeah.
He's not of it. It's more selfish means in the book why he wants to release Hyde or effect this change. And he's not as nice in a person, not as noble as he is in the movie. Because they really make him out to be this great humanitarian that everybody likes.
And that's what Mamoulian wants to do. Like I said, he's trying to separate not the good from the evil necessarily, but the higher, you know, sort of spiritual man from the lower carnal man.
Yeah.
That's his intent. So to establish Jekyll is almost this angelic figure. What he does, when you look at the scene where he heals the little girl and she's walking, you know, and like I said, that exultation in her face, and, you know, and I'm walking, sir, I'm walking, and she's shaking and her hands are out and she's looking at him with these huge glistening eyes.
Isn't it even like in soft focus?
Yeah.
Like almost like an aura around her.
Well, it's not so much soft focus, but there is an aura. It's just the way that it's lit.
Yeah.
You know? And it's like a religious scene.
Yeah.
So again, you know, Jekyll is this sort of angel or even Christ figure to some extent,
yeah.
You know, and Hyde is the devil. And I think that's definitely how Mamoulian wants you to receive it. But for me, and again, this might just be me, I cannot observe, and this might have something more to do with how I see the world and how I see people, as a matter of fact, not being a particularly spiritual person, I must say. I can't absolve him for Hyde's actions. You heard me mumble it a little bit when we talked about how good the scene, where Ivy meets Jekyll is for the second time,
yeah.
is, where yeah. she's begging for his help and all these things. And I say it makes you hate him. It makes me hate him. Maybe that probably doesn't have that effect on anybody else because I'm looking at him thinking, this is your fault. You did this.
You know, but it's not just you because his doctor friend, when he exposes himself as here's the change, here's what I've done, he's like, well, you're responsible.
Yeah.
You need to own up to this.
Yeah.
You know, you need to let go of your girl.
Yeah, I'd forgotten about that. You're right. Yeah.
So it's not just you. It's just.
And he doesn't.
No, he doesn't.
Which implicates him even more. You know?
Yeah. And like at the end where they break, or maybe it's one time before that, where did that guy go? They break in the lab. Says, oh, he went out the back door.
Yeah, yeah.
And they go in it's locked from the inside. And he's like, but yeah, and that the doctor is you.
Yeah.
At this point. Or is
I'm that guy.
Yeah, or is everybody else that's not, you know, oh, poor Dr. Jekyll. You know, which I'm with you. I mean, he shouldn't have done it to begin with. Okay. But he did, so he needs to take responsibility for his own actions. And maybe there's a lot more deeper stuff we could get into about that, but I think we've been talking for about an hour and a half or almost two now.
Yeah.
So, and we don't want to make this a two-parter. But I think to get into it deeper, we may have to do a little more research or watch it again to get into more philosophical of who, you know.
Yeah.
Who is he really at fault or, you know, or which he is. But it's like I said, I've said it numerous times and you can edit out all of them if you want. Just leave one. watch the movie. I can't say enough how thrilled I was after I watched it that I watched it again and discovered it new.
I'm glad. I mean, I'm glad that you did, and I'm glad that you felt that way about it because I think it really charged this whole episode of Phantasma.
Yeah,
Dark,
I mean,
feeling that you're feeling right now.
I'm going to watch it again this week, and with everything that I've got in my head from watching it before and the notes I took and stuff we've been saying, I'm going to watch it again this week and look at it in a different way, I guess.
Yeah.
But enjoy it more because it's one of those. I think there's a lot more going on in it than most everybody's given it credit for over the years. Because you really, like I say, you really don't hear a lot of people talk about it, and it's a damn shame.
Yeah.
Because it's every bit as good, if not better, than most of the top tier Universal films. And to take nothing away from Frankenstein, which is one of the best, if not the best, Universal film, and The Wolfman, which is my favorite, and is a damn fine film in and of itself, which we've talked about before. To take nothing really away from them, it's just it's a different kind of film and succeeds on a lot of different levels that they don't.
Yeah. True. And quick note on Miriam Hopkins.
Oh, yes.
I had this thought. I wanted to share it.
I got some thoughts about that. I don't want to share them, though.
Well, you know, she was a pretty big star. I mean, she was one of Paramount's major stars in that era. And, you know, you don't really – speaking of, talking about – you don't hear as much about this film as you might. You certainly don't hear as much about Miriam Hopkins as she might.
Yeah.
I think cinephiles know her for sure. But I mean,
which is
she's
a
not,
shame.
You know – everyone has some vague idea, at least these days. I mean, you know, it was more than vague when we were young. But in the current day, I would say everybody has at least a vague idea of who Bette Davis is or who Joan Crawford is or whatever. But you probably don't know about Miriam Hopkins. And I have a half-assed theory that one reason why that is because her best work was in the pre-code era, and a lot of that stuff just wasn't seen, you know, wasn't played in revival houses and wasn't played on television for a very long time after the code came in, and it sort of
I'll buy that. Yeah,
I think it kind of buried her legend to some extent. I would recommend, if anyone is interested, the pictures that she made with Ernst Lubitsch. one of my personal favorite directors, namely The Smiling Lieutenant with Marie Chevalier. Trouble in Paradise with Herbert Marshall. And did you know that Miss Hopkins starred opposite Frederick March in another film a year after this one?
I read something about that, but I can't tell you the film.
It's called Design for Living. It's, again, directed by Lubitsch, and it stars Hopkins, March, and Gary Cooper. And the film is basically about a menage a trois between the three of them. Right. So Lubitsch's pictures in this era are, for the most part, sophisticated sex comedies.
Yeah.
So you can't really cut this scene or that scene out of them and still have them work.
Yeah.
Which is why they just weren't seen very much for a long time. Which
Do you have that
probably,
film?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
We need to watch that sometime. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Yeah. Actually, like I said, all three of those ones that I mentioned.
She's a beautiful woman.
Yeah, yeah.
Man, smoldering.
Well, in Smiling Lieutenant, which is a musical, Chevalier marries Miriam Hopkins, who is this sort of shrewish, spoiled rich girl.
Yeah.
And Chevalier's ex-girlfriend, sultry torch singer Claudette Colbert, has to teach Miriam to keep her man by being sexy.
Oh, man.
Yeah, yeah.
Get the popcorn. Let's go, man. I'm in. I'm in for that.
So definitely check out those Lubitsch pictures with Miriam Hopkins if you're curious.
See, the more you know. Wow. Cool. I think I'm spent.
Yeah, me too.
This was a good one.
Yeah, it was. It's a great movie. We don't talk about movies we don't like, for the most part. Not yet, at least.
No.
And I don't know that we will or not. But, so we always say this is a good movie and you should see it for everything that we talk about. But this is a great, great film. And if you haven't seen it, do yourself a favor and check it out.
What he said. Good night, Gracie.
Good night.